Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
I did it because the artistic community came and saw the work I'd done in Pakistan and said, we've got nothing, we've got no art school, we've got no film school, we're teaching ourselves all of these things.
A new documentary chronicles the story of the creative space, the Yellow House in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, that continues to produce films and performances despite the return of the Taliban. Keep listening for all this and more coming up on The Wire Weekly. But first, a group of MPs in New South Wales have called to exempt medicinal cannabis users from the offence of driving with the mere presence of the drug in their system. Last year, the government's drug summit recommended a legislated medical defence for drivers using medically prescribed cannabis, but it has not been legislated. Ruby Ward asked Dr. Michaela Kowalski, research fellow at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, how we can define presence versus impairment in cannabis users on the road.
Yeah, so that is kind of the important question when it comes to driving under the influence of THC or with THC present. So look, what we know from research that's conducted throughout Canada and the US, who are quite further ahead in this field than we are, but also locally at the University of Sydney, is that THC does cause impairment. It is affected by recency. So from research that's come out internationally, is indicating that the impairment can last like up to 3 or 4 hours is the thinking from the time that the THC was consumed. And of course, if this was edibles based, then that time frame gets extended because of it being slow release in the edible form. So they are kind of connected. The challenge in detecting recency and also impairment, and the field that's kind of addressing this is trying to find innovative ways to detect both.
Recently, Army veteran Michael James was charged after being found with cannabis in his system. It had been 12 hours since he had taken the medication. What kind of research has your field been looking into with recent use and impairment of the cannabis?
So, yeah, again, the field is trying to kind of look at both. And there is also this influence of kind of the breathalyzer from alcohol coming into play about hoping to find an equivalent for cannabis. And there are breathalyzers that can detect trace amounts from THC cannabis, particularly if it was smoked in the preceding 2 to 3 hours. It's currently undergoing field testing and validation. It's not available on the market yet, but that's something that's being looked at, again, out of California and the United States. There's also much more common is plasma testing, swabs. Those are kind of much more common and found out in the field. We also know that police around the world try to also use like behavioral tests that are quite similar to tests that are trying to detect impairment from alcohol, but those aren't probably not as well suited for cannabis because the physical manifestations of impairment of alcohol and cannabis are quite different. So those are probably not as reliable.
It sounds like the states have got innovative ways to test these kind of things. What are some global policies around cannabis reforms and cannabis testing?
While there's interesting things happening in the space of cannabis policy reforms throughout the world as far as kind of approaches to possession, use, even home like cultivation, growing your own cannabis that we see cropping up in different places around the world, when it comes to actually driving, almost all jurisdictions around the world have bans on driving with the presence of THC. There are jurisdictions that have recently tried to put in limits on like levels of THC. So that's in place in Germany and also a handful of states in the United States. And then a different response we see in policy is policy that tries to ban driving impaired. as opposed to driving with THC on board. So the policy scope around the world is kind of following. Most places either don't allow for any THC to be on board or allow for certain levels of THC, such as in Germany. And then again, there's this approach of trying to have a policy where you do not allow for driving under the influence. But again, we see in places like Canada, one of the ways that you can be under the influence or impaired, and that can be measured, is to see if you actually have THC on board. So it's quite tricky, but broadly speaking, we seem to be in step in New South Wales with what's happening around the world when it comes to driving.
Dr. Michaela Kowalski, a research fellow at the National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre, speaking there with Ruby Ward.
Whenever I want to catch up with current affairs in Australia, I head to thewire.org.au or I follow them on Twitter. I just search for The Wire Radio, all one word. And yes, they're on Facebook too.
Yesterday, Strike Force Pearl arrested two men in relation to the string of anti-Semitic attacks across Sydney. The Alawar Synagogue, a childcare centre at Maroubra, and a residence and torching of cars in Dover Heights. It's not clear whether this was linked to the expulsion of Iranian diplomats from Australia, but one of the men is described as being the mastermind behind the campaign. In the Gold Coast last week, the Mayor's Summit Against Anti-Semitism was held to share strategies to combat hate and to promote social inclusion at the local level. Liz Cush has this story.
During last week's Australian Mayor's Summit Against Anti-Semitism, I spoke with Dr. Ron Weiser, an advisory board member of the Combat Anti-Semitism Movement. I asked him why the summit had been organised and what it hoped to achieve.
So part of the plan will be, we hope, that the councillors will go home and take a plan of management, first their definition of anti-Semitism, which is the IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition, to understand what anti-Semitism is, and then to institute different councils in different ways, basically copying the Waverley Council template for dealing with anti-Semitism at the local level.
Would support for boycott, divestment and sanctions of Israel be considered anti-Semitic under that definition?
Boycotting the Jewish state is definitely anti-Semitic, absolutely, without a question.
Why do you think that the attempts to boycott and divest from Israel over war crimes in Gaza are not a legitimate form of protest?
It's got nothing to do with what's going on, about alleged war crimes there or not. We're talking about here, and it's a perfect example of your attempt to try and take it to a foreign conflict that we're trying to avoid.
How do you respond to criticism that combat anti-Semitism movements lobbying for the IRA definition is an attempt to stifle protest against Israel's genocide in Gaza?
Firstly, there is no genocide in Gaza being perpetrated by Israel, but this is not a conference about genocide. This is a conference about combating anti-Semitism here. We are not, attendance at this doesn't make any representative have a particular policy on Gaza for or against. It's all about combating anti-Semitism here, restoring social cohesion in Australian societies, and making sure that whatever problems may exist in other parts of the world are not brought in here to disrupt Australian society.
One of the summit sponsors is Southern Steel, a shareholder in Bisalloy, which supplies steel for armoured vehicles used by Israeli forces. Do you see a concern about this leading to Israel's current war on Gaza?
The federal government itself says that they're not supplying any, no Australian company supplying any equipment to the military in the Middle East, and I think that would. That's just an answer that should survive from that level.
Yaakov Aron is a Jewish Australian journalist. He co-authored an investigative article about the Mayor's Summit that was published on Michael West Media. I asked him to share his views on the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement.
Boycotts, divestment and sanctions are essentially what was published in the advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice on 19th of July 2024, when it said that individuals, entities, states and organizations must not engage in trade that entrenches Israel's military occupation, which is illegal in the occupied Palestinian territory. And unfortunately for Israel, almost its entire economy is based around the military-industrial complex. Israel has never been at peace since its independence in 1948.
Yaakov, you spoke at a forum on the weekend in Sydney that described the mayor's summit as a scam summit. The program highlights social inclusion. Why do you not see the summit as a legitimate way to combat anti-Semitism?
I grew up as an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and I'm very proud to be Jewish. The difference is that I am not a supporter of the Zionist movement or ideology or of the state or government of Israel, which sets me apart from the people behind this summit. It is formally partnered with Israel's cabinet ministries of strategic affairs, the Ministry of Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism, and the Israeli embassy in Australia, as well as several other national institutions of Israel. So I believe that it is very much about twisting the definition of anti-Semitism so that it silences critics of Israel.
Yaakov Aron, an independent journalist at Michael West Media, ending that report from Liz Cush.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
In June 2023, people coming back from a wedding in the Hunter Valley suffered an horrific bus crash. 10 lives were lost, dozens injured, and the nation was left asking how such a tragedy could happen. Thomas Kudas asked John Gaffney, the father of the groom whose son was injured in the Hunter Valley crash, and also a retired engineer in traffic and road safety, to reflect on the experience and the safety measures currently in place on buses. We warn that this story does contain content that some listeners may find distressing.
Difficult time. I should point out that it's still a difficult time for many of the people involved in the bus crash and their families. Some people are struggling, and quite a number aren't working 2 years on or able to work at their full capacity. So it's quite a significant event. I have been able to reflect on seatbelts on buses. And I suppose in a summary sense, when we had two very big bus crashes in 1989, when there's a shortage of bus drivers in the pilot strike that we had, by 1996, the regulations were meant to be changed so that seatbelts were installed on all buses. But a loophole has allowed many buses to be built and operating on our roads without seatbelts. And it's only next year we will see the federal government plug that hole, the loophole that allowed new buses to be built without seatbelts.
Why are seatbelts still overlooked on coaches and tour buses despite being legally required?
Well, the loophole was if the back of the seat was less than a metre high, you didn't have to fit it. They left it in a clause in another specification that the industry made use of. But the real issue is it took 10 or 20 years to get everybody to wear seatbelts in cars, 55 years ago almost. And there was campaigns and education to get people wearing them on buses, on cars, but we never did the same sort of campaign on buses. And there's been no enforcement. I'm not aware of anybody who's been caught not wearing a seatbelt on a bus. That if you have a law and you don't enforce it, and a lot of the buses are also overcrowded with people standing, and one day there's going to be a serious injury, because if the bus has to brake or swerve or stop quickly, humans can't hold on even at 30 kilometres an hour. So they'll be thrown right around and severely damaged. So, it's just a loophole that's fallen through the cracks. And to close that question out, our buses are about five times more dangerous per registered vehicle than the sum of all the other vehicles on the road. And if you take the distance they travel into account, they're about three times more involved in serious injuries and fatalities.
You know those little alarms that go off where it says seatbelt must be on or something like that? Is that still like a safety sort of feature that's making us safe, or do you think more needs to be done?
Everything's adds and cumulative. I'm being negative here. If there's lots of alarms going off in the bus, because the bus might have 45, 50 seats, it's going to end up distracting to the driver, I would have thought. So it's not necessarily a real answer. But if I can just give you an example of, we recently had a federal election, and the thing that I noticed on the television was the politicians weren't wearing seatbelts while they're travelling along, and their media crews. So we've got a real problem where it's just not seen as a thing to do in wearing a seatbelt on buses. It's just a real cultural problem. And an ad on TV for a few months or whatever is not going to solve that problem.
So do you think that bus operators should be held accountable for encouraging or enforcing seatbelt use, but also responsible for the fact that people are not putting them on?
I'm always a bit wary of overloading drivers with responsibility. However, I think with the new policy, they're looking at doing announcements, but every time the bus doors close or whatever, that you've got to have a seatbelt on, that's a good start. If it's a school bus, the teachers should be responsible, I would have thought, to make sure the students that were travelling with them on a bus, say a school excursion, should have their belts on.
So what you're saying is it's our responsibility to sort of make the decision to put our seatbelts on?
Well, ultimately, I believe it is the individual's responsibility, but without a carrot and a stick, so a stick and a carrot or whatever, the culture, we haven't changed since the Hunter bus crash. There's no statistics in any of the states to suggest there's one more person wearing a seatbelt.
John Gaffney, the father of the groom whose son was injured in the Hunter Valley crash, and a retired engineer in traffic and road safety, speaking there with Thomas Kutis. And if you or someone you know needs some support, please call Lifeline on 13 1114.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Visual artist George Gittos is known for chronicling war zones across the world and providing a space for culture to flourish through his involvement in art communities around the world. A new documentary, Yellow House Afghanistan, focuses upon the longevity of the Yellow House in Jalalabad. Stephen Hill asked George Gittos to describe the genesis of the Yellow House and the struggle to keep it open.
Well, the Yellow House came about not because we thought of it. I made the film Miscreants of Tullywood that you can get on SBS On Demand about 16 or 17 years ago. And as a result of that, it was very anti-Taliban. A letter was sent to the Australian embassy in Islamabad offering to cut my face from my body, not my head off, just my face from my body. And, so it took a lot of courage to go to Afghanistan because they're connected with the Taliban in Pakistan. And I did it because the artistic community came and saw the work I'd done in Pakistan from Jalalabad and said, we've got nothing. We've got no art school. We've got no film school. We're teaching ourselves all of these things. Can you come and help us?
So the film continues your champion of art as a means of overcoming conflict and promoting connection on a human level. In Afghanistan, this must be a challenge requiring the building of relationships in the local community. Can you talk a little bit about how you're able to negotiate to ensure the Yellow House continues to remain operational?
When the Americans withdrew, it was so chaotic and everyone thought that the Taliban taking over may mean that the Yellow House could not continue. But it's all about giving. And how I first came to Afghanistan was not to do the Yellow House. Went there in the 90s after the Russians had left, and they'd left landmines everywhere. And I worked with Australian deminers to help get rid of the landmines, document it, and create a program to teach children and other people how not to handle landmines and lose their arms and legs. And that's how I really learnt the language, you know, interviewing many mine victims. And I even had a letter from Mullah Omar, who invented the Taliban, telling me that I was cool. One of the most dangerous generals, you see this in the film too, he fought the Americans, and he was like number three on their list after Bin Laden that they wanted to kill. We got a message from one of the young Taliban. He was coming one day, and we didn't know what was going to happen with him because he was like a fighting man, notorious. And he said about 8 bodyguards ahead to make sure that we didn't have guns and that we were okay and we weren't going to try and assassinate him. They lent their guns on the walls. We put carpets on the lawn and in the garden, and he came with about 30 of his men, you can see them all sitting around the garden, and they had a great time. And then at some point he looked at me and he said, you know, we have a culture of honouring the guest, but if we find the guest is betraying us, we kill them. And that was a bit of a warning. But now we've got just super endorsement from every level and everywhere with the Taliban. But it has been scary and has been difficult.
So you've been also been involved in helping to establish a film industry in Afghanistan.
Yes. All of our work at the Yellow House came about because we'd made Pashtun language films in Pakistan. So that's where it started. And they had self-taught themselves to make films in Afghanistan. Majru, who's the head of the Film Society, invited us there for that first meeting. And a lot of things they just didn't know about filmmaking. So we're running a film school and it's ongoing. And they use our equipment, our cameras, our editing equipment, and our editors show them how to use computers. We partly did it because there are these cultural problems, particularly with women, that everyone knows about with the news. So we thought, you can't change that culture with a gun like the Americans thought they could and the Russians thought they could. So we made films featuring women, like we made one called Talk Show, where there's a woman who has a talk show, like Oprah Winfrey in Afghanistan. That would have been impossible. But now that's happened. We're worried that men buy films and they're only buying action films from Pakistan and India from the CD shops. So we got a whole tribe of ice cream boys to sell them with ice cream so mum could put her money over the fence and sit down with the kids and watch one of our films. And it brought about social change. You know, we really know that women who come and thank us who are now working on Afghan television.
Filmmaker and visual artist George Gitto speaking there with Stephen Hill. And Yellow House Afghanistan will be screening at the Dend in Newtown on Sunday, September 14. George Gitto will be there to answer your questions. Climate change is being addressed in the South Pacific by looking at how they should address changes in rainfall patterns and temperature changes. In the Cook Islands, they've suffered from a serious drought, which has affected what they grow and how they grow it. I asked Selene Tyrer from the Cook Islands Centre for Research at the University of the South Pacific whether variable rainfall was the biggest concern for farming in the Cook Islands.
So for the changes in weather that have been major impacts in the Cook Islands, it has been our droughts. Although rainfall is being an issue, but it's more of the lack of rainfall. So with our droughts, with a lot of our growers, especially those who are really experienced, they are noticing this as like major issues because with their experience, they're used to the droughts coming at certain times of the year so that they're able to prepare for it. But because of climate change and the seasons becoming more unpredictable, it's getting a bit harder for them to click on when they should start switching their methods and when they should start preparing for these droughts.
One of the things that you were focusing on was that you could actually look at what would grow under the current conditions rather than trying to make things grow when there wasn't enough water. But is there a problem also with what people like to eat and like to buy? Is that also a cultural issue?
Not so much a cultural issue, but more of a priority issue. So with our people, we are focused on providing food for our communities, but we're also very economically driven. And for the Cook Islands, we have a big tourism industry that's our main source of income. A lot of the growers tend to change the crops that they grow to suit the tourism sector. So they're growing more stuff like watermelons, cucumber, tomatoes. Although the locals love eating these, they try to grow more of those because they're more popular with our tourists.
And they sound like they need a bit of water as well.
Yes, yes, they do.
So that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it is.
There's a lot of growers who have got a few tricks up their sleeve. What are some of the things that they're doing to cope with the lack of water?
So the interesting part with these guys is that because they've been growing for a very long time, they use a lot of traditional methods, one of which would be our Te Arapo, so it would be planting by the phases of the moon. Our fishermen use this calendar sometimes as well, but our growers use it a lot to help with growing our crops and to help help them predict the drought sometimes, which is something that our younger growers don't really have access to because they don't have their traditional knowledge yet or they don't have that information yet.
What has Australia been doing for the Cook Islands and what could they do?
That's a good question. So far, most of the collaborations with the Cook Islands have been with New Zealand and some of the Asian countries. So maybe this is a good time for Australia to come and either do some capacity building with us, share with us some of the systems that they use for their agriculture and their water management. Because for us, our islands are changing. We need new systems to be able to adapt to those changes.
One of our other speakers from Papua New Guinea was talking about private-public partnerships. Would maybe something like that help people in the Cook Islands?
Yeah. So one of the disconnects that was identified when the Punavai Marama and our Ministry of Agriculture had the information session with our growers was that our tourism providers was saying that there is a gap in the market when it comes to the growers who have the produce and then the people in the tourism sector that want that produce. There's a bit of a gap trying to figure out like how do they get that and how do they supply that. And this even extends to exports as well. So a lot of our growers are ready and they are keen to be exporting some of their goods, but knowing how to do that, knowing where it can be sent, and a lot of the admin surrounding that, they would need a little bit more help with.
Selene Tarea, Research Officer, Te Puna Ve Marama, Cook Islands Centre for Research, University of the South Pacific, and speaking with me there. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.